Down Against the Grain. Children are being diagnosed with increasing rates of autism, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and bipolar disorder. Theories abound about the spike in these conditions. But what if the root problem is, in fact, a society that medicalizes normal childhood behavior? I'm Sasha Lilly, clinical psychologist. Enrico Naulati joins me to talk about kids, psychiatric diagnoses, and the medical profession. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Psychiatric disorders in children seem to be skyrocketing. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimate that 1 in 54 boys and 1 in 252 girls have autism spectrum disorder. Over the past 10 years, the number of cases of bipolar disorder have increased 40-fold, and it's estimated that 1 in 10 children have ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. But what is missing from these numbers, and the attention paid to them in the popular media, is something remarkable. Large numbers of children no longer have what are supposed to be lifelong disorders by adulthood. 3/4 of kids with ADHD no longer have the condition by their mid-20s. The same is true of 1/3 of teenagers diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And 1 in 5 toddlers diagnosed with autism no longer meet the diagnosis several years later. So what's going on? Are these disorders somehow waning? Or are children being misdiagnosed with these disorders at an alarming rate? Enrico Naulati takes the latter position in his book, Back to Normal: Why Ordinary Childhood Behavior is Mistaken for ADHD, Bipolar Disorder, and Autism Spectrum Disorder. That's published by Beacon. Naulati is a clinical psychologist specializing in childhood and adolescent therapy and assessment, and he joins me today. Enrico, let's start with autism. I know you're not suggesting that autism spectrum disorder isn't a real disorder. Why don't you think actual autism is on the increase?
The statistics show that there's been an almost 80% increase over the past decade. And now the rates are like 1 in 88 children supposedly are on the spectrum, like 1 in 54 boys. So boys are diagnosed about 5 times the rate of girls. And I can hopefully at some point talk about, sort of the abnormalizing of boys. And that I see as a one of the trends that is making diagnoses, autistic diagnoses, spike. But I would say no, that it's a very kind of complicated phenomenon to really understand why these numbers are spiking. I think that it's partly there's the well-intentioned practice of wanting to engage in early screenings for autism spectrum disorder. It's a public health imperative. But unfortunately, the younger in age we assess for autistic spectrum disorder, the greater the risk that a struggling or slow to mature toddler, especially boy, will be erroneously assigned a diagnosis, at least those that inhabit the mild end on the spectrum. I think toddlerhood is probably the period of greatest diagnostic uncertainty, and most of the new cases are, involve toddlers.
So, what are the behaviors that therapists look for in toddlers, in young children, to diagnose autism?
Well, first, you should know that diagnosing true autism is not that difficult in my estimation. So whenever we're talking about a clear-cut case of autism, there may not be language development, or there may be minimal language development. There may be that the subjective sense that a child is unreachable emotionally, that they're in their own world. They may have a blank stare on their face. They're sort of like they're relatively non-responsive or frequently non-responsive. They don't necessarily laugh when you laugh. They don't feed off others' emotions. So that would be a big sort of subjective criterion. They may be fascinated by they may engage in a lot of seemingly unusual, repetitious behaviors, spinning around in seats, staring at spinning fans. They may have tantrums that that are prolonged, where they appear inconsolable if there's sort of small changes in routines. So I think on the extreme end, true autism, and I'm someone who really wants to reserve that diagnosis for kids that really are truly autistic for a variety of reasons that we can get into. But so in that regard, it's not particularly difficult to diagnose true autism. Where it becomes complicated is on the milder end, where most of the new, which applies to most of the new cases. So it's your, so now we call it autism spectrum disorder, and we see it as a on a continuum from mild to severe, and it's on the mild end that it becomes, I would say, very kind of problematic to tease apart what is a true case of mild autism versus a child who's slow to mature, or he's are struggling in a variety of ways. And many mental health professionals are not trained to really distinguish between kind of the outer edges of normal, especially in toddlerhood, when it comes to, you know, tantruming, picky eating, social and emotional skills and whatnot.
Right. Sounds like toddler behavior. But what is the danger of diagnosing children with autism being on the autistic spectrum if they don't in fact have autism? Isn't there a danger in not acting on the suspicion that a child might be autistic? Aren't there some therapies that could mitigate the developing disorder if it's caught early enough in childhood?
I mean, that's a very good question. Here's the rub, that oftentimes a struggling toddler who may be slow to acquire language, who may tantrum out of the norm, who may have, you know, gross and fine motor difficulties, and that, you know, and so there's challenges there, but they're really not autistic, oftentimes can benefit from the same services that are given to mildly autistic children. So it becomes this strange phenomenon where I think many parents get caught in the trap where they want the services, and so they reluctantly will embrace the diagnosis in order to get the services. I don't think that parents should be put in that quandary. I think that we should have a more liberal access to services that struggling children can get without having a diagnosis. So in other words, you shouldn't have to have a severe diagnosis in order to get certain speech and language services, in order to get occupational therapy, in order, you know, get social skills play therapy. I think those services should be kind of widely available without, because once you go down the track where the diagnosis is assigned, other dominoes can start to fall. A diagnosis can follow a child into the school system. Some educators and some school personnel will fetishize that diagnosis. It will shape their image of what that child is capable of. They may be categorized differently, perceived differently. And as long as the diagnosis follows that child, there can be other unanticipated negatives. So, you know, as that child gets older, there are a range of, especially in the world of social media, where employers do background checks, where, you know, we want to assume that medical records are safeguarded. You know, every month there's a new story that comes out in the newspaper about leakages of big data systems. That we can't assume that medical information will remain confidential. That information can get out. It can hurt a child's as they emerge into adulthood. It can affect their employment opportunities. There are lots of jobs, believe it or not, that you cannot get with certain diagnoses. In order to get an airline, you know, to become a pilot, certain, you know, positions in the military, law enforcement, high security jobs around the country, there are, you know, screened for mental illness. And so we want to assume as a society that we're much more liberal about mental illness. And we certainly talk about these diagnoses in very folksy ways, ADHD, bipolar disorder, autism. But when you really dig into the research, we as a society, the stigma of mental illness is every bit as strong as it was a generation ago. So we have to be careful assigning a serious, autism is not a frivolous diagnosis. Neither is ADHD. And neither is bipolar disorder, which are the three most common diagnoses assigned to children these days. And I think we've just become far too casual in assigning what many veteran clinicians like myself have always believed are severe, lifelong, debilitating mental illnesses. And so we shouldn't assign these kinds of diagnoses casually just to get services.
That's the voice of Dr. Enrico Naulati. He's a clinical psychologist and the author of Back to Normal, Why Ordinary Childhood Behavior is Mistaken for ADHD, Bipolar Disorder, and Autism Spectrum Disorder. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and I'm Sasha Lilly. Well, let's turn to one disorder that's diagnosed at even higher rates than autism, and that is ADHD, or Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder. One in 10 children are thought to have ADHD, which is a phenomenally large number. Perhaps you could just start by saying what the characteristics are that a child needs to have to merit that diagnosis.
Well, there's two different types. There's three different types. There's the ADHD, predominantly hyperactive type, and then there's the ADHD predominantly inattentive type, and then there's the combined type. So, you know, it's possible to have ADHD and not be sort of impulsive, hyperactive, you know, overtalk, have problems waiting your turn, and this sort of thing. You can be forgetful, distractible, disorganized, have trouble kind of planning and following through, and still get the diagnosis. So long story short, you're talking about kind of a grouping of symptoms that has to do with kids who are, to a fairly dysfunctional degree, impulsive, distractible, forgetful, disorganized, restless, and fidgety. Now, the trouble is that also parallels aspects of childhood itself, right? So all children to varying degrees are, you know, impulsive, distractible, forgetful, disorganized, fidgety. And what gets considered ADHD or not is often based on the adults in a child's life subjective comfort level with an effectiveness in handling these kinds of tendencies. So, and frankly, over the years, and I do a lot of assessing of ADHD, and I in some regards I'm a traditionalist, even though I write critically of the diagnosis, but I still assess it in fairly conservative ways, and I distribute questionnaires, and I am really, really intrigued by the fact, and have been for decades, that I will distribute ADHD type questionnaires to a variety of individuals, adults in a child's life. And I would say that probably only 25% of the time will I get sort of common profiles that converge on ADHD. So in other words, maybe I'll distribute it to two teachers, each of whom have radically different perceptions of a child, two parents, radically different perceptions of the same child. So it's very interesting to me that we underestimate just the subjective, and there really is no objective measure of ADHD. In other words, you can't peer into a child's brain, and that technology doesn't exist and might not ever exist. So we really rely on adults' subjective reports, in addition to other things, you know, tests of attention and concentration and whatnot. But to get the diagnosis, you have to be symptomatic in two different environments. So home and school, or home and church, or, you know, so it can't be that you're a child is symptomatic just in one environment. So actually studies line up with my own experience over the years that if you distribute questionnaires to adults that interact with children across environments, instead of just having a parent fill out a questionnaire and a parent alone or two parents alone, the incidences of ADHD drop by 40%. So, frankly, when it's being assessed, it should be, in order to get the diagnosis, you have to be symptomatic across two environments. Every evaluator should always have multiple adults in a child's life complete questionnaires so that it can actually be accurately diagnosed. But that is actually the exception rather than the rule currently, and one of the reasons why the diagnosis is you know, overutilized.
So what are the consequences then for a child of having this diagnosis? You mentioned earlier with autism that there can be a whole range of things that can follow that child even into adulthood in terms of the stigma. But with ADHD, what about medical interventions into childhood behavior at an early age?
Well, there you go. I mean, with autism, there's really no tailored medication. You may medicate certain symptoms if a child happens to tantrum a lot or whatnot, but the diagnosis of ADHD is almost a given then that child will be it will be recommended that medication be looked at. So a diagnosis of ADHD, as distinguished from autism, medication now becomes a primary consideration. And, you know, now you get into the whole topic of the pros and cons of medicating children where there's a questionable diagnosis.
And what are the consequences for the growing body of taking these drugs, especially if they are, in fact, unnecessary? Are there studies about the impact on children?
That to me is a very, very complicated question. And we, you know, depending on the age of the child, I mean, there are those that would say that we should be putting, you know, Ritalin in the water, so to speak, like fluoride for, you know, cavities. If there's a new generation of children that we're raising with like new media that have short attention spans that kind of, disadvantage them and you know, chalk and talk classroom environments, why not should we just liberally prescribe it for performance reasons, as a medicinal corrective for a nasty cultural trend? So there are those that would argue that, and so, you know, where's the harm, especially, you know, with the psychostimulants that have been researched for decades. And you know, there are millions of children on them. There are risks and benefits. I can get into those if you want, but all the way to the other extreme, where you know there are those that say we really don't know what long-term psychostimulant use what the effects are on the brain. The research that I'm familiar with pretty much concludes, and actually this is some of the best research that's out there, that psychostimulants are scientifically supportable for up to about 2 years. The research shows that for about 2 years, there are benefits for the majority of kids that have ADHD, but beyond 2 years, that's not the case. In fact, if you look at the research, upwards of 80% of children that are diagnosed with ADHD and put on medication by the time they're in their early 20s no longer take meds. And upwards of 75% of kids diagnosed with ADHD as children no longer meet the criteria for the disorder, you know, by the time they hit their mid-20s.
But is that because they're growing out of the disorder, or is that because they were misdiagnosed in the first place?
My position would be that large percentages of them were misdiagnosed in the first place, and I can present some of my ideas on kind of, you know, the confines between what I call normal childhood narcissism and ADHD, and we don't really fully appreciate what constitutes normal narcissism in children, and how it can look on the surface like ADHD type phenomena, and I can talk about that in a little minute here. But I think it's massively overdiagnosed, and as best as I can understand that, rooted in my knowledge of the literature, is that the ADHD brain is probably an immature brain, and there's actually been an NIMH brain scan study that's discovered that 75% of ADHD children outgrow it in their mid-20s. And that study concludes that what we assume is ADHD is really an immature brain. It's about 3 years behind in its maturation. And that what most kids that present as ADHD in childhood are really slow to mature and their neurological and their social and emotional development, and they just need time.
So in other words, there's an unrealistic metric that's being applied to them about where they are in their development. And I guess is then the issue, and not just with ADHD, but also with autism spectrum disorder, even bipolar disorder, are some of these things that we could say are really societal issues that have a disproportionate impact on children who might be maturing at a different rate, still within normal, but, you know, not the average? Is it, in a sense, easier to point the finger at the child than the society? I'm thinking about parental expectations and then schooling, the expectation that, especially for little kids and even older kids, that they're going to have to sit still easily for long periods of time. Is there a sort of cultural societal mismatch with children in general that particularly affects those who might be slow to mature?
Absolutely. I mean, and we, you know, if you look at kind of cultural trends just in terms of children's play experiences over the decades and their access to sort of safe places to play, I would say over the past 30, 40 years, children's play has gone from being more outdoors, more animated and kinetic, and more social, to indoors, sedentary, and isolative. So, it's very hard to kind of maybe look for kind of causal relationships that, you know, has that contributed to the spike in ADHD children. You know, the lack of availability or reduced availability to active play experiences where kids can run around, jump around, climb, exhaust themselves in the act of play, I would say that is a relevant consideration. There's even research that shows that in school districts where children are given more opportunities for free play, that they're afterwards, after recess, they're more capable of sitting calmly, less fidgety, and more attentively. So there are things like that. There's a great book called The ADHD Explosion by Stephen Henshaw, is one of the main authors, and in that book, they make the argument that you can look at, after the No Child Left Behind Federal Act, Education Act that was passed a number of years ago, you can trace the increases in ADHD diagnoses literally by the rate of implementation of it across the states. So the states that have the highest rates of ADHD happen to be the ones that, going back a decade or so, were the ones that first put the No Child Left Behind Act into practice. So some of your southern states, Virginia, North Carolina, have much higher rates of ADHD than, let's say, Nevada, California, Washington State, Oregon. Western states tend to have lower rates of ADHD. And in the ADHD Explosion book, they make the argument that that's just as an artifact of certain educational practices and certain perhaps unrealistic educational expectations that are placed on children that then make them symptomatic. And I would say that's especially boys.
Yes, well, I wanted to ask you about boys. Clearly, when you're looking at autism spectrum disorder or ADHD, boys are particularly likely to be diagnosed with these at much higher rates than girls. Why do you think that is?
That's a topic that's sort of near and dear, actually, to me. I mean, once again, I think I mentioned earlier, one in 54 boys are now diagnosed as autism spectrum disorder, about five times the rate of girls. Boys are given an ADHD diagnosis about three times the rate of girls. But partly, if we look, I think that there's a sort of now I'm going to say some things that might be controversial to your audience, but I think we're at a place in our culture where there's a sort of a phobia around talking about gender. But if you're the parent of a boy, if you've spent any time around boys in a variety of settings, educationally, clinically, whatever, it meets the eye fairly readily. Some general gender-based differences meet the eye fairly readily. So it's like boys, if you look at boys, the average boy's communication style, they're more likely to be logical, analytical, transactional, long-winded monologues about their favorite topics, may avoid eye contact, they may be brusque and blunt. They may be more likely to engage in what's called shoulder-to-shoulder intimacy than face-to-face intimacy. In other words, a verbal process will kick in while they're pursuing an activity together. Even if it's playing video games, then, many mothers wish that they could take their sons to lunch and sit across the table and have a wonderful conversation and then repeatedly get disappointed. Desiring face-to-face intimacy when what may come natural to that boy is something that's more shoulder-to-shoulder intimacy, as in going for a bike ride together, or picking weeds together, or some activity that then that helps lubricate the interaction. So you've got that going on. The average boy's play during toddler years is autistic-like. The average boy prefers playing alone and manipulating toys in a rote fashion than using them to play make-believe. Actually, if you look at the theory of mind, which is considered one of the hallmarks of autism, that is a child's ability to sort of like put themselves in someone else's shoes, put themselves in the mind of others. Like, I have a lot of puppets in my office. I ask what the puppet's sort of thinking or feeling, and so that the theory of mind, being able to sort of project one's, extrapolate from the outside about like what an object or a person may be sort of thinking or feeling. The average 3 to 4 year old girl is about twice as capable of theory of mind than the average boy. So just as a function of gender. So that's another reason why it gets overdiagnosed in boys. plus with toddlerhood too, there are a range of behaviors that are typical of toddlers that can get misconstrued as autistic. Like, about 1 in 5 toddlers are late talkers. About 50% of toddlers are picky eaters. About 1/3 of parents of toddlers find their tantrums disturbing or disquieting. So, you know, and toddlerhood is a time of stubbornness, willfulness, insisting on having control over what happens to their bodies or events around them. Stubbornness that can at times get misconstrued as autistic-like fixation on things staying the same, and you know, problems transitioning, being overly wedded to a routine. These sorts of phenomena are considered autistic-like, but they're also very developmentally appropriate for toddlers. Toddlerhood is also a period where a repetition of stimulating activities is necessary to build mastery. So stacking blocks over and over in a seemingly self-absorbed, immersed way, lining up trains in the same way over and over to obtain an experience of kinetic effectiveness and mastery, that's very consistent with toddlerhood, especially among boys. And you know, to the unsophisticated eye, that can appear autistic-like. And then the procedures and assessment conditions geared towards when autism is being assessed can often put a vulnerable or struggling toddler over the edge, making them seem autistic-like in their ways of coping. And this is the one, I don't think that we address that issue enough in terms of the overdiagnosis problem. So even with little, like, 2-year-olds, the traditional way that they're assessed for autism is that they're separated from a parent or their caregiver fairly early on in the interview. And then there's a very formal way of assessing it that for most toddlers who are attachment sensitive, that need to be put at ease in order to bring the best out in them developmentally, if the unintended formality of the assessment procedure itself can leave that toddler ill at ease. And then there are more primal ways of coping, you know, not engaging in eye contact, crawling under a table, whining, becoming non-communicative. These are fairly primal coping mechanisms of toddlers. They can make them look autistic-like. So that's another, especially with boys too, who may be less social to begin with. So these are some of the reasons I think where boys get kind of, and we're not talking about sort of malicious acts on the part of, you know, mental health professionals, and we're talking about perhaps just a need to address the question of gender and how boys develop differently from girls and how boys at times cope differently from girls and so on and so forth. Those more developmental topics and common sense topics, I think, need to be factored into the assessment procedure.
Sure, and those questions of gender are obviously very complicated, how it comes to be that boys turn out one way and girls turn out another. And although they're not being diagnosed with autism and ADHD at the same level as boys are, clearly there are also girls who are seen as exhibiting abnormal behavior to whatever expectations there are about girl behavior, you know, mm-hmm. very active, physically active little girls, and then they get branded abnormal as well, maybe not given these diagnoses, but you know, that there seem to be fairly rigid ideas about what is normal, and children who fall beyond that can really end up, you know, in a bad situation.
Yeah, well, especially in a classroom setting. I mean, I think that, you know, what is a normal activity level? What is a normal attention span? What is, you know, a normal, not all children are people, are you know, are social and given to be social and maybe more introverted by temperament than extroverted. And I think I actually think that even though in America we want to see ourselves as embracing diversity, one of the areas I think when we're probably, you know, less likely to embrace that diversity is in the social and emotional realm. Being able to kind of adapt educational, pedagogical environments to children across a range of temperaments, activity levels, attention spans, and whatnot.
Dr. Enrico Naulati is my guest. We'll return with him in just a moment. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Enrico Naulati. He's a clinical psychologist specializing in childhood and adolescent therapy and assessment, author of the book Back to Normal, Why Ordinary Childhood Behavior is Mistaken for ADHD, Bipolar Disorder, and Autism Spectrum Disorder. That's published by Beacon Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. I'd like to turn now to a diagnosis that is frequently made within adolescence, and that is bipolar disorder. There's been an explosion of diagnosis of bipolar disorder. And I wonder if you could tell listeners what are the characteristics of bipolar disorder and then how they get frequently, as you see it, confused with normal, albeit sometimes unpleasant behavior.
Well, classic bipolar disorder, it used to be called manic depressive illness, not unlike autism, I think on the surface when it's present in its clearest form, is relatively easy to diagnose. So some of the hallmarks of bipolar disorder, what clinicians call it a labile mood, someone who can go from being relatively chipper and upbeat to tearful or enraged, with some minor kind of precipitant, so true mood swings, what triggers that those mood swings on the surface seem fairly inconsequential. So you've got that, you know, a high degree of impulsivity, a lack of a need for sleep. So someone who might go a day or two without sleep, impulsively calling family members in the middle of the night. Maybe they're hypersexual and impulsively acting out sexually. There's also what's called tangential thinking. So a person may jump around and their verbalizations going from one thought to another without there being, you know, a great deal of internal consistency with sort of what they're talking about. And then pressured speech is one of the hallmarks of bipolar disorder. Motor mouth, someone who just is talking endlessly with pressure, like they can't help but say what needs to be said and say it as long as it needs to be said. These are some of the hallmarks of bipolar disorder. The criteria shifted about 20 years ago that really then created, I would say, sort of a dragnet for teenagers that are going through a fairly difficult adolescent passage to be misdiagnosed. So agitation became one of the hallmarks of adolescent bipolar disorder or pediatric bipolar disorder. So kids who would just had a short fuse and would flare up and agitation. So teenagers who really showed unusual signs of just becoming enraged and slamming doors, yelling, screaming, becoming highly argumentative. Teenagers with that presentation now were more likely to be assigned a diagnosis to the exclusion of some of these other classic symptoms of bipolar disorder, which was always kind of confusing to me. Merely a kid who was just sort of like agitated and impulsive to unusual levels. Ooh, now that would be a kid that in the current zeitgeist would be on a clinician's radar to get a diagnosis of bipolar disorder.
Adolescents are, of course, famously known for not getting enough sleep. And I was wondering how much of this is a factor in the behaviors that then are perhaps misdiagnosed as psychiatric disorders.
I have a whole section in my book on that, and I agree with that basic premise. Like kids that have chronic sleep deprivation and overuse caffeine in ways that can impair their sleep can present with reduced self-regulation of emotion in general, so more irritable, more moody, more cranky, shorter fuse, and cognitively cloudy, and problems concentrating and attending. I think that chronic sleep deprivation is probably one possible pathway to a false diagnosis.
The program's Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm joined by clinical psychologist Enrico Nalotti, author of Back to Normal. Well, let's talk about this bigger picture that you've been discussing through the hour of what you see as the overdiagnosis of various psychiatric disorders. Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder being one, bipolar disorder, autism spectrum disorder. What drives this overdiagnosis? You've talked about it in different ways, but I wonder what are the key facets that have led to such an increase in these diagnoses from this generation to the last. You've mentioned somewhat the orientation of doctors and therapists in making diagnoses. To what degree does their education influence the tendency to give children psychiatric diagnoses?
Well, I can start there, but I think there's a complex web of factors that sort of explain these diagnoses that we've been discussing. I mean, I agree with you that the sort of the education and training of health and mental health professionals often lacks adequate background in child development. They often don't have a good paradigm in their head for what constitutes normal, and what they do have is often of a textbook academic nature. They may be well versed in identifying abnormality, but have a hard time teasing out what is on the outer edges of normal, comparing that to what is actually abnormal. So it has partly to do with the education and training of health and mental health professionals. As upwards of like 40% of new child psychologists haven't taken any courses in child development. 40% of pediatricians haven't even completed a residency in pediatric mental health. So, it has to do with the education training of health and mental health professionals. It has to do with, the obvious, the spectacular marketing success of the pharmaceutical industry, making the American public easygoing about medicalizing and medicating children's behavior. I think as a society, we become casual, loose, and folksy in discussing childhood diagnoses. So much so that by the time a parent enters a doctor's office, they sort of nonchalantly self-diagnose their child. I mean, if you've watched Simpson episodes, South Park episodes, you know, the shows on ADHD, they showcase ADHD in popular culture in ways. The word hyperactive, the term short attention span, forgetful, ADHD, we use it in such folksy ways. Most new cases of ADHD occur in a pediatrician's office. The average length of a pediatric visit right now is about 15 minutes. So, you know, if a parent comes in already predisposed to kind of use symptom language, and they confront with a pediatrician who wants them to cut to the chase and use clinical shorthand to arrive at a diagnosis, you could see how the conditions seem to promote a quick diagnosis. The diagnostic habits of mental health professionals have also changed. There's much more of a trend towards what's called upcoding or rebranding. In other words, assigning a more severe diagnosis in order to authorize services through insurance companies. Insurance companies have just become much tighter in what they'll approve of in the way of services. And many clinicians adapt by upcoding, assigning a more severe diagnosis in order to just authorize services. So these are some of the reasons why I think over the past few generations, we've seen, you know, an uptick or a big uptick in, you know, these diagnoses.
Can you tell us a bit more about the role that pharmaceutical companies play in influencing the diagnosis that children get around these mental health disorders?
Well, one of the big ones, of course, it has to do with a pediatric bipolar disorder. In fact, it's only now that we've really seen the light, so to speak, that pharmaceutical companies promoting what are called off-label uses of what are called the newer antipsychotics. These are medications like Abilify, Seroquel, Geodon, Zyprexa, Risperdal. These medications are extraordinarily profitable. In fact, Abilify, I believe it was in 2014, was the most profitable drug of any drug in America. And it's used for treating bipolar disorder. And one of the reasons that drug in particular and the others that I just quoted have had, you know, been prescribed in skyrocketing rates is deeply wedded to the more looser and more frequent diagnosis of pediatric bipolar disorder. The pharmaceutical industry went out of its way to handsomely reward psychiatrists and pediatricians who would openly promote the uses of these off-label uses. They're not approved, many of them, by the FDA for use with as an approved medication for pediatric bipolar disorder, but physicians are allowed to prescribe medications for what are called off-label reasons, and the pharmaceutical companies sort of took full advantage of that loophole going back a decade or two and promoting these newer antipsychotics that became highly profitable and really shaped many clinicians' diagnostic habits. We're just coming to terms with that right now. A lot of the abuses in the system have been uncovered, and there are new rules that are applying. I think under the Obama administration that physicians can only get like $1,000 or something like that if they give a talk to a pharmaceutical, you know, from a pharmaceutical company to promote a medication. Before, it was the sky was the limit. And doctors could make millions of dollars flying around using kind of sketchy research to promote off-label uses, in particular of the newer antipsychotics, to address what, you know, pediatric bipolar disorder.
Well, let me end by asking you, what do you think parents should do if they feel like their children are exhibiting worrisome behavior or simply difficult behavior?
I would say you start by exercising common sense. You start, like you said earlier, Sasha, you look, you know, I look for the obvious things first: sleeping, eating, the emotional tenor of the household, are things relatively smooth and calm enough of the time, or chaotic too much of the time? Children are, we underestimate how attachment sensitive they are. If you have an occupation that makes you highly preoccupied a lot of the time, your physical coming and going sort of erratic, when you come home, when you pick a child up after school, that time varies from day to day, that alone, an erratic attachment pattern throughout early childhood can create a symptomatic child. So we start with the obvious things first. Is there a mismatch between a child's educational environment and where they're at developmentally? So I would say first start there. Then if the problems persist, then I think it's time to try to seek out a qualified mental health professional. And unfortunately, I think you're going to have to do your research to find someone who is not only credentialed, but who, you know, has a broad knowledge of normal childhood, and that maybe they themselves have kids, or they themselves were once a teacher, or they themselves once worked in a summer camp. They themselves came from a big family and were put in a parental role with siblings. Believe it or not, I think that these normal human things are, you know, add to a child psychologist's skill level and repertoire.
I've been speaking with Enrico Naulati. He's a clinical psychologist specializing in childhood and adolescent therapy and assessment. He is the author of Back to Normal: Why Ordinary Childhood Behavior is Mistaken for ADHD, Bipolar Disorder, and Autism Spectrum Disorder. That's published by Beacon Press. You can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Thank you so much for joining me today.
You are very welcome, Sasha.
You've been listening to Against the Grain. My name is Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.